everyone. Thank you for tuning into the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's May 2019, and you're listening to episode 123, which is a review of the new biopic film, Tolkien, which is in theaters now. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Philip Tallon, who is an assistant professor at Houston Baptist University, where he chairs the apologetics department and teaches great books in the Honors College. He's also the author of The Poetics of Evil and has an essay in The Hobbit and Philosophy. Phil has written an online exclusive film review of Tolkien, and it's called Tolkien's First Fellowship, and it's available free online at our website, equip.org. Phil, it's good to have you on.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Well, I also want to warn listeners that, as with all of our film reviews, there will be spoilers. So if you feel like you need to see the film first, turn this off and come back to it later. But I'm sure that this film, for those who see it, will introduce a different side of J.R.R. Tolkien to people. I think most pop culture connoisseurs know him, or know the name anyway, best from the series of films that were done on The Lord of the Rings. And so, given that, I'm sure some of those fans who like the intellectual property of Lord of the Rings might, you know, be interested in this film. So will those fans, those Tolkien fans who maybe haven't read the books, and maybe even the ones who have read the books, will they enjoy this film?
That's a little hard to say. I think that the movie is aimed at a general audience, and that it's very likely to annoy, you know, hardcore Tolkien fans because of things that it leaves out or little mistakes that it makes, or I don't know, just the lack of depth of engagement with the material. But I think that if you really don't know much of anything at all about J.R.R. Tolkien, except he's the guy who wrote the books that were made into those movies that maybe you saw in the theaters, and you want to learn more, I think this is a perfectly fine place to start.
And so given that in mind, it kind of also just goes over, I'd say it goes, oh, he doesn't try to cover his entire life. It just goes over the beginning of his life up to the time when he's just about to write his works. I think he's just about to write The Hobbit, I believe. So how successful is Tolkien as a film?
Melanie, and you're right that it actually, the movie takes on, you know, a bit of underexplored territory, which is, I think that, you know, people who read Tolkien are likely to be familiar with some of the bigger facts of his later life, you know, that he was friends with C.S. Lewis and that he, you know, lived through the Second World War and, you know, became a famous author. But this takes on a little bit of underexplored territory, which is his earlier life, his service in World War I, called the Great War, and also his relationship with the woman who would become his wife, Edith Bratt. And so, you know, it's not like this material has been done over a million times. It's, you know, a lot of the kind of the big things that, you know, we see on screen were, you know, still fairly new to me. And so, I think that it's a relevant work to make in that regard. And, you know, and I think that it's decently well done. This is a perfectly fine Hollywood film.
As I mentioned, only the early part of his life is covered in the film, not, you know, later, like you mentioned, his friendship with C.S. Lewis and other writers. But in the film, it focuses on this early literary society that he formed with some fellow schoolmates, some other boys. And I found that to be really interesting. But wasn't he, you mentioned Lewis, wasn't he in another society later when he was professor at Oxford? And tell us about both societies, and especially also the later society. What was it called? And did it have the same purpose as the first society that he was part of, where they went to have tea together with some of his classmates?
So the movie, and the best part of the movie, I think, is the relationship that Tolkien has with this group of classmates at his swell school that he attends. And because he's a bright boy, he's sent off to a good school despite being orphaned and being fairly poor. He makes these bright, much much more well-to-do friends, and they form a society of, you know, they call it the TCBS, which stands for the Tea Club Barovian Society, because of some particular details about where they gather for tea. And they encourage each other in the film and their artistic endeavors, and they also encourage each other to become just men. They, you know, they talk about bravery, and they, you know, dare each other to do brave things. And this moves from being just kind of boyish hijinks into, you know, being something which is genuinely honorable. And so they, their friendship is, does what, you know, Aristotle and others say friendship should do, which is it helps us to become better than we would be alone. And this is the center of the movie. This is what it keeps coming back to. I think this is the, these are the best parts. And I think this is some of the material that people are likely to be unfamiliar with as Tolkien's relationship to this earlier literary artistic society. And the movie doesn't go into Tolkien's relationship to another fellowship that he has later on in life, the Inklings, which was also incredibly important and influential in his life. Tolkien's group of friends, including people like C.S. Lewis, Owen Barfield, Charles Williams, C.S. Lewis's brother Warney, gathered regularly. They encouraged each other in their artistic endeavors. They had a kind of a countercultural position. They wanted to make things that the world, the wider world, didn't value, but they loved. And it was because of this fellowship that Tolkien was able to finish writing The Lord of the Rings, arguably the most significant novel of the 20th century, certainly one of the most influential and most popular. And without that regular kind of fellowship, the encouragement of people like C.S. Lewis, Tolkien would not have been able to become the writer that we know him to be. And so gathering around a group of people, you know, who encourage you is an important thing, and clearly incredibly important in Tolkien's own biography.
The film focuses on his particular fascination with languages. It has a scene in which he quotes from Chaucer, which, if you've ever tried to read Chaucer, and I was an English major, it can be a slog. And he, you know, quotes from it from memory. And then he also, everyone might know, not all people would know if they haven't read the books, that he has this Elvish language that he invented that is used in Lord of the Rings and the Cimmerillion, maybe. I haven't read the Cimmerillion. Actually, that's also a slog. And they make this point that it's based on other languages in the film. So why was study of language important to Tolkien? And what's the significance of creating this Elvish language that's in his work?
Yes, well, Tolkien from a very early age, or Tolkien from very early ages, was trained by his mother in Latin and other languages, and he was adept at picking up languages, and so picked up many of them and had a interest in Finnish, you know, relatively speaking, you know, fairly minor European language, and, you know, loved some of the rhythms and cadences and mythology of Finnish, and then began to create his own languages. He created not just one type of Elvish language, but two, Quenya and Sindarin. And then he also created, you know, basic grammars for other languages, and such as Dwarvish. So Tolkien, you know, loved to, you know, think through how other languages might work. And he loved the beauty of words. This is a point that the film goes on about a bit, how he loves the sound of particular words, and he wanted to, you know, create, in creating a language, you can give beautiful sort of signifier. You can make beautiful signifiers for things that they're signifying, which are also beautiful. So he could, you know, construct a language that's really kind of like made sense and worked for him. And this seems to be one of the original impetuses for Tolkien's whole larger project. He loved these certain phrases, and he wanted to create stories that go with them in order to kind of enrich them and ground them. And this is connected in other ways to his larger kind of philological concerns. But basically, he was an incredibly creative guy who understood language incredibly well, had so much creative energy, spawned his own languages, and then worlds kind of tumbled out as a result of this original project. So it's no doubt that this helped stories like The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings become incredibly popular, because there's this kind of depth and solidity that they have, because Tolkien has spent so much time thinking already about the world that he's telling a story in, different kinds of languages, different sorts of registers, ancient, archaic, you know, versions of the language, and more recent ones. The Shire have very kind of humble, simple, common words for things. And then as you kind of move deeper into the story, you get into this, you know, higher elevated elvish register, and it gives us this sense of journey from the commonplace into the to the mysterious and archaic. And so this private interest, the secret vice, as he calls it in one essay, of creating languages enabled him to bring together his philological interests, his desire to create mythology, his love of mythology, and his storytelling.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Dr. Philip Tallon, who has written a Christian Research Journal online exclusive film review of the movie Tolkien, and it's called Tolkien's First Fellowship, and it's available completely free online at our website, equip.org. We'd also like to invite you to subscribe to the Christian Research Journal. A subscription is $33.50, and to subscribe, please visit our website, equip.org. When you subscribe to the Christian Research Journal, you will join the team of print subscribers whose paid subscriptions help provide the resources to minister to people worldwide who come to our website seeking to be equipped. And these resources include our free online articles as well as this podcast. In addition, we'd like to encourage you to support this podcast by partnering with us. You'll find a link on the landing page of this episode on equip.org, and it's a link to a special offer for two books on the work of J.R.R. Tolkien. So for your gift of any amount, you can either receive The Messiah Comes to Middle Earth, or the other book, The Hobbit Party, The Vision of Freedom That Tolkien Got and the West Forgot. Or for your gift of $50 or more, you can receive both books. So we'd like to thank you in advance for your partnerships, because your donations help to keep this podcast free. Well, one of the criticisms that has been lobbied against this film, I think, on various different, you know, religious websites that are reviewing it, is the fact that they assert that this film downplays Tolkien's very deeply held Christian faith. So what do you think of that? Does the film have a view of Christianity? How does it present Christianity? And does it really explore his Christian faith?
You know, it presents it briefly. I think that criticism is entirely fair, and it's one that I lodge as well in my review. You know, it doesn't. I think it shows in some sense that this biopic lacks a kind of integrity about, you know, tell the whole story of Tolkien's life, in that it spends a fair amount of time on his linguistic interests. It's obviously concerned with describing how he becomes the storyteller that we know today, but then leaves out this other key element, which is his own personal faith. And at times it even, you know, goes so far, I think, as to suggest that faith, you know, kind of isn't really that important for Tolkien, and that we see him early on, and when he begins going to this new school, he doesn't seem to know the words to the hymn that they're all singing, which suggests that he's kind of an outsider of the church. And then in the next scene, he's able to recite Chaucer from memory, you know, so it looks as if, you know, his priority is in, you know, the literary world, and he has very little interest or concern with Christianity. Now, this is a, you know, largely speaking, kind of an omission. There is a fairly sympathetic portrayal of a priest played by Cole Meany. People know him from various Star Trek shows. And he's a, you know, he's sort of a gruff, stern figure in some ways, but is also, you know, sympathetically portrayed and seems like someone who's genuinely trying to do right by everyone. And so that, you know, that figure in a sense kind of represents the presence of Christianity, but really leaves Christianity, as it were, in the domain of the this priest and doesn't do anything to show us how faith is infused throughout all of Tolkien's work, even in places that I think most people don't realize it's present. The Lord of the Rings is shot through with Tolkien's theology, and you know it's infused so deeply that people can miss it. I have a friend who used to listen to someone read Lord of the Rings on the internet, and it was being broadcast on a Satanist radio station. Because they just love this, they love this book, and so he was listening to the story being read by people who oppose Christianity. So deeply kind of entrenched, as it were, is Tolkien's theology that it may not be visible to people who don't realize it's there. And so, this film may suffer, as it were, from the same blindness about the presence of Tolkien's Christianity.
You were mentioning that you had a friend that was listening to someone read the book. And I remember, not totally related to this podcast, but just about, you know, how we've consumed Lord of the Rings in my own house. But my oldest son, who's now graduated from college, when he was, I think maybe in first grade, he loved to build Legos for a long period of time. And I thought, well, why don't you? And he wanted to see the movies. At that time, the movies were coming out. And I said, well, you need to, of course, he was not old enough to read the books. I said, you need to, you know, listen to the book on tape before I'd let you see the movies. So he listened to The Fellowship of the Ring, all unabridged, however many, you know, dozens of hours that was, or 15 hours or whatever. And then I remember him seeing the first film because he was quite small. And then his main question when we left was, whatever happened to Tom Bombadil? He's not in this movie. But anyway, you know, when I saw the movie, even as someone who has read The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, I still came away, you know, lots of times when you see those biopics, you go ahead and you Wikipedia, did this really happen? And there were a lot of really true facts. I thought, you know, just his origins, you know, becoming an orphan was very Dickensian, but that really happened to him. And so then it makes you, you know, just wonder who he was as a writer. And since they don't really explore, you know, the work that he does that he's so well known for, since it ends when he's just beginning to write The Hobbit, why don't you, you know, tell our listeners, what are some of the common themes that are in the work of Tolkien so that they can be a little bit more familiar besides just kind of like, you know, really just storytelling some facts about who he was, which I feel like this biopic was a little bit like, you know, a dramatized Wikipedia entry about him.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that's a fair point. This is, you know, this movie just kind of dutifully hits some of the big beats and does so in a workmanlike fashion. But, you know, anyone who sees this, or if you want more Tolkien, I mean, there are an incredible array of wonderful books to read. So I article I recommend, Bandersnatch, is potentially one that by Diana Glier, a Christian writer, talks about the kind of mutual influence of the Inklings. It's delightful. But there are many themes in Tolkien's work. I mean, so, you know, it's Tolkien loved nature. He was, you know, interested in trees. This theme comes out throughout his work. We have talking trees, and he, you know, loved different kinds of flowers and stars, and was a keen observer of the natural world, and really mourned the destruction of the English countryside that came about as a result of the rise of industrialization. And so one repeated theme in his work is the value of simple life. Hobbits are simple people. At the end of the book, The Hobbit, Thorin dying, you know, says that it would, you know, perhaps be a better world if, you know, people were more like hobbits and just valued kind of cheer and simple things instead of striving after gold and riches. And this is a deeply held view of Tolkien. And in fact, it's one that he connects with the entire creative enterprise. Tolkien's view of creativity was that it was this wholesome and good activity that humans can engage in, which enables us to be sort of productive, but without damaging the world around us. It's a kind of a way of being like God, creating small little worlds that we can play together in and enjoy. And that they're free to do, you know, it's basically, you can tell a story. It doesn't cost anything. People can enjoy it and enter into it. It doesn't consume resources. And then kind of, as it were, leaves the wider world unharmed. And this is a, an unusual maybe lesson for someone. We don't think of the Inklings as being environmentalists or, you know, being terribly concerned about these things. But this was a deep concern of Tolkien, was the damage that we're doing to the creation. There's another theme that runs throughout Tolkien's work, which is relevant for this discussion of this film, which is that, you know, it's the nature of evil and the presence of evil in the world and how evil will eventually be defeated. And so we see throughout Tolkien's writings that there's the sort of great danger, and evil is very real, but there is a sort of a hidden providence that guides things, and that if we can trust ultimately that that this providence will work all things together for good in the end. And so, you know, we have in The Hobbit and in The Lord of the Rings this kind of heroic journey, which seems at times to be doomed. This just can't end well. I'm going to go and do my best, but it's probably not going to work. It's probably going to end in failure. But then, you know, providential guidance makes it such that at the darkest moment, hope, you know, again reemerges. And Tolkien really, you know, viewed, you know, kind of hope as being something which is kind of woven into the fabric of creation by the creator, and that we can kind of hold on to this hope even in these incredibly dark moments. And obviously, given his experience in the Great War and World War One, you know, Tolkien saw terrible evils, and was not unacquainted with death and destruction, and even despair. But so his work doesn't have superficial optimism. He recognizes the reality of tragedy, but he thinks that there is still there's always the possibility of ultimate hope. And so he shows us this through these, you know, incredibly surprising, joyful, happy endings. He thinks these happy endings sort of echo a deeper truth about the world that God has made than tragedy does.
You were just talking about providence in his work. And I remember, I didn't notice this till I was an adult, because when the movies came out, I reread Lord of the Rings. And I think when you're a kid, you don't read the appendix portion. And in the appendix, when it talks about the various history, what struck me the most, I mean, I came away with my rereading, was just that idea of, you know, at the inn, at the Prancing Pony Inn, so many years earlier, Gandalf had met up with one of the, I think, dwarves or something like that, quote unquote, by chance. And that just starts everything that happens so many years later. So he was really good at just weaving that into the stories. You know, because when you're little, this is very interesting to you. So I remember getting into it because of C.S. Lewis, and I loved the Narnia series. And so I was reading those, I think, you know, when I was in fourth or fifth grade, and to me, I could really easily see the allegory in it. You know, this character is Christ and these different things that were happening. And then, so when you go to the Lord of the Rings, it didn't seem like it was written in the same way to me. And of course I was just a kid, so I just really wasn't, you know, familiar with it. And so I was wondering, is Lord of the Rings allegorical? Because I think some readers, because if they know that he was friends with C.S. Lewis, they're going to discover his books. And if it's not allegorical, how is Middle Earth different from Narnia? Because they're both like these fantasy realms that you really want to inhabit with all these different characters.
Indeed, yeah, they are two different works. And Tolkien had thoughts on, you know, Lewis's much more hodgepodge, kind of fruit basket turnover style of fantasy, which is he's going to kind of put everything in there. And that gives it a, you know, particular character that, you know, Tolkien was not after. He wanted everything kind of ironed out and ordered and kind of all of the background pieces in place. And Lewis as a writer was, you know, was much more kind of speedy writer. He could knock things out one draft, Lewis. And so these are two very different men, and the different characteristics of their books are obviously notable. I wouldn't necessarily say that the Narnian Chronicles are allegories. I think they're, Lewis himself denied that they were allegorical. But they are closer to allegory than what Tolkien is doing, in that Lewis describes the Narnian books as kind of starting with this what if, which is say, what if the second person of the Trinity, the Son of God, became incarnate in a different world? How would that play out? And so naturally there are kind of points of reference where we see, oh, okay, this thing Aslan is doing is like what Jesus did in our world. And so we can find those natural points of connection. And that's the sort of allegory-ish quality to Narnia. Tolkien said he politely disliked or disdained allegory, though he wrote one himself, Leif by Niggle, which is about his own attempts to get Lord of the Rings done. But what he preferred was not allegory, but what he calls applicability. He says, you know, history is applicable. You know, you can look back in history and say, oh, their situation is like our situation. And so what can we learn by comparing these two things? And so the Lord of the Rings has lots of applicability to our own context. So the ring of great power that's really too dangerous for any good person to wield, you know, Tolkien said is, you know, it's not, he wasn't trying to represent the atom bomb as some people thought or other, you know, contemporary technologies. It was its own thing, but we can still learn and apply lessons by thinking about Lord of the Rings to our own situation. Oh, how should we responsibly wield power? How much power should any one person, you know, possess? Tolkien has thought through these questions in his own world, and then we can apply them over to ours. So really what Tolkien is doing is he's trying to create an internally consistent world that, you know, so all the things that he ultimately believes to be true about, you know, our world, that, you know, there's a God who created these things, the nature of morality and so forth, all these things still hold, you know, human nature is still what it is. But things are, you know, things are somewhat different. There are wizards running around and there are these magical artifacts and there are different sort of species of humanoids and they're interacting in certain ways. And so you change some of those pieces and then that enables you to kind of play around with possible scenarios, but we can still draw lots of points of connection. In fact, maybe we can think through these things more easily because they're a bit removed from us. So instead of being too close, too entrenched, we can think a bit more objectively about secondary worlds, as Tolkien calls them, because they're a little different from our own. And that there's a point in the film that they sort of say something that reminiscent of this after the First World Wars, or after Tolkien is back from the war, he's talking to the priest, and the priest says, you know, I talk to widows all day long. I barely know what to say. But the only words that help are ancient words. He says modern words are no good. And so he speaks the liturgy to them. But the suggestion, of course, is that the way that Tolkien is going to sort of speak about these horrors is through fantasy. He's going to write these fictional stories. And I think that's a good point. The sort of distance that fiction gives us often enables us to reflect on things a bit more carefully and objectively.
What are some of the literary and cultural legacies of Tolkien's work, and why do you think his work has so much staying power after more than 75 years? Why do people still feel drawn to Tolkien's work?
That's a great question. Tom Shippey in his book, J.R.R. Tolkien, Author of the Century, you know, makes a case that Tolkien is the most influential author and the most significant author. And I'm persuaded by the case that he makes. One place where we see this legacy is in how many different products now are focused on world building. You know, they're not just trying to make kind of one single unit of art that sort of stands alone. The old Hollywood way was kind of you make a movie and somebody likes it, then you make a sequel, right? And the sequel is rarely as good, not given as much attention. And there was no plan for the sequel when you made the first one. Well, now, you know, we have these big sweeping TV series and film series where there's an incredible planning that goes in to, you know, to its Marvel Cinematic Universe building over the course of 22 movies or whatever, you know, just to get to these points and laying in little clues along the way. And so that kind of sweeping mythological world building has become commonplace. It's still difficult to do, of course. I mean, it's not like it's just, it's easy. Anyone can do it, but this is not, you know, basically anything that other writers, actually not many other writers were attempting at the time that Tolkien was writing. What he was doing was unfashionable. And I think he did it better than anybody had done it before, and probably honestly better than anybody will ever do it. This was the work of his entire life, creating these languages, the background mythology that we find in the Silmarillion and other places, the, you know, children's book of The Hobbit, and then the sweeping novel of The Lord of the Rings. This consumed, you know, basically one incredibly brilliant Oxford teacher's entire life. And I think it's very unlikely that we'll find anybody else as brilliant, as sort of well-educated and as passionate as Tolkien. So this is a unique achievement, but doesn't stop the rest of us from being influenced by his labor and trying to replicate that. So that's one part of his legacy, is I think the mythological influence. The other thing that I think is part of his legacy is honestly his profound Christian theology, which he deeply weds to his mythological project. And I think the depth of his thinking is present throughout his work. And even if people don't know that what he's doing, they feel that, you know, in the same way you can tell if a couch is well made or poorly made when you sit down on it, even if you're not thinking about it, you know, sort of, you can feel when you're driving in a car, if it's a high quality car or low quality car. So Tolkien's work is incredibly high quality. There's this integrity there. He was trying to, as it were, find a way to synthesize and bring together and kind of hold together European mythology as well as Christian theology. So he's finding these little scraps of text in old manuscripts that are isolated, and he's weaving stories that hold them together, and doing all of this, you know, with the understanding that there's a creator God who's good and has brought everything into being. And so, you know, there's a line from, you know, an Anglo-Saxon poem that mentions this, you know, Earendel, brightest of angels. And so Tolkien creates a story about how an elf named Earendel, you know, becomes a star. And this, you know, so he's borrowed something from an Anglo-Saxon Christian poem, sort of a scrap. He's told a story about it in his background mythology. And then, you know, this even comes into play in Lord of the Rings, when Frodo is being attacked, you know, he calls on Earendel, you know, so this is all kind of throughout. So in just these little things that we see in the movies or reading the books, you know, that might just kind of seem like a random detail, Tolkien has thought about each of these little pieces, and that integrity of his thinking is profoundly satisfying artistically. And I think, you know, you can continually return to him and just find more and more and more riches. And so we are not done plumbing the depths of Tolkien.
Well, finally, I want to end with some fun rapid fire questions for Phil. So Phil, it's May and various fruits are in season. Would you rather have strawberries or pineapple?
Oh, I think good strawberries are about as good as anything. Though, you know, pineapple normally is just always fine. So depends on, you know, good or bad. This is a profoundly important question for fruit.
And in your free time, do you prefer to read fiction or nonfiction?
Oh, I prefer to read fiction. The most of my reading now is, you know, reading kind of old great books, and the fiction ones are always the most pleasure. And that's, I think most of my nonfiction now I'm getting through, you know, podcasts and you know, web articles and that kind of thing.
Well, it's almost summer, so vacation away or staycation at home?
Oh, vacation away. We cashed in all our frequent flyer miles, and I'm taking my wife and my two oldest daughters to England for the summer. And in we're going to be gone most of July. We'll go through Oxford and see some Tolkien sites, and I think we're going to have a fine time.
So for vacation, relaxing on a beach or visiting a museum? Now, it sounds like from your vacation, it's not going to be a beach vacation.
Well, no. I mean, if I grew up in Florida, and the thought of going to a British beach just seems terrible. So I will definitely be going to, we'll let the Floridians do the beaches and we'll let the British do the museums.
Well, thanks, Phil, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Yeah, always a pleasure.
Today's guest is Dr. Philip Tallon, and he's written a Christian Research Journal online exclusive film review of the movie Tolkien, and it's called Tolkien's First Fellowship, and it's available completely free online at our website, equip.org. We'd like to invite you to subscribe to the Christian Research Journal. A subscription is $33.50, and you can subscribe by going to our website, equip.org. And, you know, when you subscribe to the Christian Research Journal, you'll join the team of print subscribers whose paid subscriptions help provide resources to minister people worldwide who come to equip.org to be equipped. And these resources include many of our free online articles, our online exclusive articles, which includes film reviews and television series reviews, as well as this podcast. And so we'd like to encourage you to support this podcast by partnering with us. You'll find a link on the landing page of this episode on equip.org, and it's going to take you to a special offer for two books on the work of J.R.R. Tolkien. For your gift of any amount, you can either receive the book, The Messiah Comes to Middle Earth, or the other book, which is called The Hobbit Party, The Vision of Freedom That Tolkien Got and the West Forgot. Or for your gift of $50 or more, you can receive both of these books. And we'd like to thank you for your partnership, because your donations help to keep the Postmodern Realities podcast free. We'd like to hear from you, so connect with us on social media, like the Bible Answer Man Facebook page, and follow CRI, Christian Research Journal, Hank Anagraff, and the Bible Answer Man on Twitter. And please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man channel on YouTube. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities podcast on iTunes, and please rate and review our podcast. When you rate and review our podcast, it helps others see our content. And please share this episode on your social media accounts. Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast, hosted by CRI President Hank Anagraff, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888-ASK-HANK, Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. In addition, head to iTunes and subscribe to Hank Unplugged, Hank's audio podcast. Follow Hank off the grid, where he has in-depth conversations with some of the brightest minds discussing topics you care about. So until our next Christian Research Journal author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast.